Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 2nd, 2006. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. Despite a resounding rejection on November 7th by the American voters, the Cheney-Bush administration is continuing on a policy course which, if they are not removed from office in a double impeachment, will lead to a total catastrophe for the United States and for the world. While Bush's lunatic stubbornness is a big part of the problem, and of course he's insisting that we stay the course, even though that course has been an unmitigated disaster, it was Vice President Dick Cheney who took the initiative to launch the next phase with his November 25th trip to Saudi Arabia. Lyndon LaRouche has warned repeatedly that if Bush and Cheney and the financial forces behind them are not stopped, the world will be plunged into warfare for the next 100 years in a clash of civilizations that will ensure a new dark age for generations to come. In response to Cheney's trip, our guest on the show today, Jeffrey Steinberg, sent out a memo behind the Cheney trip to Riyadh, which has received wide circulation both within the United States, in government circles, military and intelligence institutions, postings on websites, and it's also been translated, Jeff's memo, into Arabic, Russian, and other languages, and is shaping the worldwide response to this latest example of the Cheney-Bush insanity. Jeff is with us today to discuss the implications of the Cheney trip. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hi, Harley. How you doing?
Good. And joining us later will be our panel of LaRouche Youth Movement members. Today we have Mike Vandernat, who's in Detroit, Nico Paulson in Washington, D.C., and Laura Gerlach in Seattle, and they'll be engaging in discussion on these deeper implications as well as the organizing process that the LaRouche Youth Movement has unleashed to make sure we can realize the potential that was opened up by the thumping, as Bush called it, of the neocons on November 7th. So, Jeff, with the significance of this memo that you drafted, why don't you just give us an overview of the salient points on what was behind this Cheney trip to Riyadh?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that in the run-up to the November elections, we played a major role in preempting plans that Cheney and company had for an October surprise. There were widespread indications that there was an intention to launch a preemptive military strike, primarily a bombing campaign against Iran, in the weeks running up to the November elections as a way of trying to salvage what everybody knew was going to be a political disaster for the White House and for the Republican Party. We put a massive public spotlight and were joined by a number of leading military people who came out publicly warning about both the folly of a U.S. Airstrike against Iran or potentially an Israeli airstrike with U.S. support. And as the result of that, they were forced to call it off. There's nothing more devastating for a covert operation than to read about it in the newspapers before it happens.
And, Jeff, that was part of what people have called the general's revolt against the policy overall.
Exactly. That was a sort of a rolling revolt that really began in the spring but really picked up again in the weeks leading up to the election. Now, there's been a hoax perpetrated centered around upcoming report of the Baker-Hamilton Commission and a so-called internal review of the Bush administration. The hoax is the claim that the Bush administration is considering changing course and adopting a new strategy towards the Middle East, one that would more emphasize diplomacy rather than shoot first and ask questions later. The hoax is now exposed. Basically, what we found out from sources in the Middle East and here in Washington was that Dick Cheney went to Riyadh to meet with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and proposed to the Saudis, as well as to the other members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, along with Jordan and Egypt, that they form a Sunni alliance, an alliance of Sunni Muslim states that would be aligned with the United States, perhaps NATO, and with Israel in a confrontation against Iran, which is a Shiite Muslim state. And so the idea was to actually foment a conflict within Islam, within the extended Persian Gulf, Eastern Mediterranean region, that would put one faction of Islam against another in what would lead to an unambiguous religious war that would go on forever. That was the crux of Bush's policy. Now, a day after Cheney made that trip to Riyadh, President Bush was traveling in the Baltic states, and he came out in his own dumbed-down way and basically said no change of course on Iraq, no withdrawal until total victory, and we're not going to talk to the Iranians. So what kind of policy review is going on? What's the prospect of anybody at the White House listening to whatever comes out of Baker Hamilton?
Jeff, let me ask you on that. Isn't it the case that Bush has gotten at least a précis from the Baker report, that he was briefed on some of the aspects of what's going to be released later?
Well, you know, President Bush has trouble reading. And it may be that the Baker-Hamilton Commission presented a coloring book, and the president was able to actually sort of put his mind around it and figure out what was being said. But, I mean, from what I'm hearing, the president's mental state is deteriorating by the hour, and that relations between Bush and his father are at an all-time low point. So, again, a few weeks ago, Newsweek magazine ran a cover story called Father Knows Best, suggesting that Bush would learn the lesson after the defeat on November 7th and would start listening to the sage advice of Bush Sr., Brent Scowcroft, James Baker, and the like. It was all a media fabrication. And, in fact, what we're seeing playing out right now is the very same commitment to regime change in Tehran, regime change in Damascus, that we've seen all along. We also have indications from very reliable sources in the region that the U.S. is covertly arming Sunni Muslims inside Lebanon and is covertly training and arming factions of the Fatah militias in the Palestinian territories to start conflicts against Hezbollah in Lebanon and against Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. In other words, what King Abdullah II of Jordan warned about a week ago on U.S. television when he was interviewed on CBS News last Sunday morning is that there are three civil wars in motion in the extended Middle East region, in Iraq, in Lebanon, and inside the Palestinian territories. And if these are allowed to fully ignite, then the region blows up.
Now, I want to make sure that our listeners are getting this in full. If you don't have your pencil and paper out and take notes, you should, because what you're just hearing right now is, in fact, the insider briefing. That is no longer an insider briefing, because this was contained in the memo that Jeff Steinberg drafted, that was the number one on the Google list for a couple of days when you Google up Cheney. This is the inside story of the literally insane drive toward war. And I want to make sure that people get this. You're listening to Jeff Steinberg. This is the LaRouche Show, December 2nd, 2006. We'll take your email questions. You can send them to Jeff at radio@larouchepub.com. It's radio@larouchepub.com. And I'm sorry we only have an hour, Jeff, because this is we're looking at, in a sense, the what should be on the nightly news for people to review. You threw out a number of things there. Let's just go back then to Cheney. You say he met with the King of Saudi Arabia. To what extent does this find favor with the Saudis at this point, this perspective?
Well, the Saudis, number one, are frightened about the implications of Iran developing a nuclear weapon. They're frightened about the Shiite minority inside Saudi Arabia, because they are actually a majority population in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which is where the major oil deposits are. So the Saudis, in their own right, are capable of being lured into this. Now, as I understand it, King Abdullah pressed the Bush administration to take further action to get some kind of settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. And that's another pipe dream that is completely off of the radar screen or the priorities of the administration. But I think there's another element that I need to add to the picture before we sort of dissect some of the details more fully. Cheney has let it be known, and some of the specifics have come out in the recent book by Bob Woodward, that he has three principal advisors when it comes to issues of national security and especially the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Number one, Dr. Bernard Lewis. Number two, Dr. Henry Kissinger. Number three, George Shultz. Now, the thing that binds Lewis, Kissinger, and Shultz together is that all three of them are British agents. In the case of Dr. Bernard Lewis, he is actually a veteran of the British Arab Bureau, who was dispatched to the United States as a British intelligence operative in 1974. And since that point has been a key policy advisor, first to Kissinger, then to Brzezinski during the Carter administration, and then more recently, he has been the leading advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney.
And Lewis is one of the people who would be most responsible then for this concept of a clash of civilizations, including within the Arab world.
He was the actual author in a magazine article in the Atlantic Monthly in 1990 of the term clash of civilizations, 3 years before Huntington cribbed it from him. And within the Arab world itself, this idea of inducing a fight between Shiite and Sunni Muslims is a wet dream for the British. This is classic British imperial strategy of pitting religions, tribes, other kinds of ethnic and sectarian groupings, one against the other. Number one, to foment chaos and genocide, and number two, to assure Anglo-Dutch imperial control. And Kissinger and Shultz represent the exact same policy. Mm-hmm. So Cheney is, in fact, not American at all. Whether he's smart enough to know it or not, his wife certainly is. But he is a strategic asset of a British faction, a Venetian-type faction of European oligarchism, that has as its primary objective the destruction of the United States.
Now, Jeff, this is before we go into more of the specifics, this is the key question. What do they have to gain? What is the goal of this Anglo-Venetian faction?
They want the end of the nation state so that they can proceed with their plans for world government. Furthermore, they're convinced that so long as the population of the planet is upwards of 5, 6, 7 billion people and growing, their schemes can't be realized. Therefore, right now, they find it absolutely essential to throw the world into chaos. Chaos in this phase of their drive for world government, for world empire, is an end in itself, because they believe that if China has 1.5 or so billion people and growing, if India has over a billion people and growing, then they don't stand a chance of being able to assert Anglo-Dutch oligarchical control over the planet. So they want wars that will basically vastly reduce the population of the planet to below a billion people. And if you notice, embedded in this whole situation are attempts now to induce conflicts and future wars between the United States and Russia and China. Mm-hmm. In Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations, he talked about a clash between the West and the combined forces of Islam and Confucianism. It wasn't just a clash of civilizations in the Middle East. Now, you can't have an end to the nation-state system unless the first thing that you accomplish is the total destruction of the United States. And since the close of the Civil War, in the middle of the 19th century, the British realized that they could not defeat the United States militarily, and therefore had to launch a campaign of internal destruction to induce the United States to self-destruct. And so the key to the whole Bush-Cheney presidency has been to destroy the United States in the eyes of the rest of the world and to destroy the United States from within. It's a close race as to whether the Bush-Cheney administration has done a better job of destroying the image of the United States around the world or whether they've done a better job of wrecking the economy of the United States, pauperizing the American people, and turning it into what's rapidly becoming a third world banana republic. Cheney's concept of the unitary executive is pure banana republic.
I want to go back to a couple points on this memo, just to sort of bullet points before we go into the broader implications, including what the LIM is doing in conjunction with Lyndon LaRouche to mobilize the Congress to fight this and reverse this policy of destroying the nation state. But let's just look at a couple of things. On this question of the Sunni alliance, when you had the meeting of Bush with Iraq's Prime Minister al-Maliki in Amman, Jordan, a couple of aspects of that are, of course, paradoxical. First, they released the Hadley memo, which says that al-Maliki can't basically cut the mustard, and then Bush is there saying he's our man. But also, the idea of a Sunni coalition, al-Maliki, as I understand it, is a representative of Shia interests in Iraq and is tied to Muqtada al-Sadr's Shiite forces. So what happened with that meeting in Amman?
Well, you know, it didn't go very well. Maliki refused to attend the state dinner at the palace of the King of Jordan the night before he finally did reluctantly meet with President Bush. Bush basically, and look, this was not a leak from the White House. This was a controlled delivery of the Hadley memo to the New York Times, accompanied by a briefing by a senior administration official. So they wanted the word to get out before Bush met Maliki, that they had grave doubts whether Maliki could do the job. And then they came in and they said, here's the job we want you to do. One thing they said is they want you to turn your guns against al-Sadr and his Mahdi army. And we want you to enter into a new set of arrangements with the Sunni and we'll get the Saudis to bring the Sunnis on board. Now, on Monday of this week, this coming week, on the 4th of December, President Bush is going to meet at the White House with Hakim, who is the rival of al-Sadr, who's a rival of Maliki and who heads up the Skiri organization, which is the largest of the Shiite political movements inside Iraq. And he, too, is going to be asked by Bush whether or not he's prepared to go to war against al-Sadr and the Mahdi army with his Badr Brigade militias. So it's a recipe for chaos on top of chaos inside Iraq.
Well, then you have the second of the civil wars that King Abdullah of Jordan referred to, the situation in Lebanon. We saw a large demonstration, a huge demonstration in Beirut yesterday of Christian and Muslim forces against the current government, which Lyndon LaRouche said is this demonstration is the way to get stability in Lebanon. What's going on there right now?
Well, as I said, all sides are being armed to the hilt. And remember, it was Kissinger back in 1975 who instigated the Lebanon Civil War as a model for this kind of British divide-and-conquer genocide throughout the region. And right now, the policies that are being pursued from the Bush administration are intended to harden those fault lines and trigger a new civil war. Look, the reports I'm getting from Beirut is that every night after midnight, truckloads of weapons are coming into Beirut. They're being handed out to all sides. And that in particular, the weapons that are coming in to the Sunni Muslims inside Lebanon are being delivered through elements of al-Qaeda, who are the conduit for projects that are being run by the Saudis. And the U.S. is turning a blind eye to this and letting it happen. So it's like Afghanistan all over again, except this time it's not just Afghanistan. It's the totality of Southwest Asia.
And, Jeff, as far as the situation with Iran, this is still number one on Cheney's hit list, regime change in Iran, either through an Israeli strike or a U.S. strike. Is that right?
Right. And also, Syria is being given an ultimatum. Break with Iran or you're next.
Well, from this overview, clearly it should be evident to people why this memo has caused such a response, because we are looking at something which is without doubt, when you see it as a whole, as a totality, it's clear that this has nothing to do with stability and security for nations in that part of the world, including Israel. So the conclusion you would think that people would draw is that this is about a permanent war situation. Now, you've been doing meetings on the Hill. You have an extensive network in the retired military intelligence community. Are they getting this idea?
Very clearly. Up on Capitol Hill, the big issue for the Democrats is regime change in Washington. Through the oversight hearings leading to impeachment of Cheney and then Bush, this is the agenda, because, in fact, the election on November 7th represented nothing other than a mandate for regime change in Washington. And you've got a freshman class of new Democrats coming into the Congress, most of whom didn't expect to win, and most of whom got virtually no help from the Democratic Party. And they're now coming in with a clear understanding that they were voted into office to impeach Cheney and Bush. So that's going to be the driving dynamic in Washington. And I think that among the congressional Democratic leaders, all of this talk about no impeachment is a thing of the past. This is clearly the direction that they've got to go in. And the Democrats know that they've got 2 years to prove that they can do something different with the majority in both houses of Congress than the Republicans did. So it's a war against Cheney and Bush that's going to start up right after Congress is sworn in on January 4th or 5th, whatever the date is.
Well, Jeff, we're going to hear in a couple minutes from LaRouche Youth Movement organizers who have been who were part of this political revolution that took place on November 7th, and what the LaRouche youth movement is doing leading up to the January 4th convening of the Congress. But I know Lyndon LaRouche has just completed a new paper on the new politics. And this, in a sense, comes from his understanding and direction of the LaRouche youth movement and the campaigns. Give us a little sense of what he means by the new politics, and also if this is part of what is getting through to these new congressmen.
Well, the principal cause, almost the overwhelming cause, of the Democratic landslide victory on November 7th was an unprecedented turnout of young voters. Two categories, 18 to 25-year-olds, significant increase. In other words, the university age youth population. And an even larger increase in turnout from among 25 to 35-year-olds, so-called young tweeners. There was a net increase of over 2 million votes on the part of young people, and those votes overwhelmingly went to the Democrats, and that is the sole reason why the Democrats are now coming into a majority in both the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. And that is a reality that has now sunk in with a lot of people in the Democratic Party. The poll numbers, election data, the details are unmistakable and unassailable. It was a youth vote that gave the Democratic Party the victory on November 7th. And very little of the effort among the Democratic Party per se, you know, Howard Dean and the DNC in particular, had anything to do with turning out the youth vote. The LaRouche youth movement moved onto the campuses, energized youth, created a mass effect by an extensive volume of literature circulation, campus interventions, and the like, and it triggered a radiating effect. It took a relatively pacified, demoralized, and disinterested youth population and energized them to action, and it was decisive action. And now American politics are no longer the politics of the checkbooks of George Soros and Felix Rohatyn and people like that. It's back to the lower 80%, and in particular, it's back to the youth who are preparing to inherit political leadership over the course of the next decade, and they're not happy with the world that's being turned over to them.
This harkens back to the theme of Keisha Rogers' campaign for state chairman of the Democratic Party in Texas, out of the bushes and into the future. I think one aspect of this decisive nature, which is not understood by certainly the idiot pundits who say, well, these were close races, is that Democrats won in districts where the Republicans had won in 2004 with 60% of the vote. So this extra margin of 2 million youth was a decisive turning point, and we'll take up the implications of that right after this short break. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you miss it live, it is archived on the LaRouchePub.com website. You'll see on the left-hand side of the website a bar that says The LaRouche Show, and you can listen to this show or any of the past shows, and you can use these shows to organize your friends, as each week we bring the kind of insight that you don't get from anywhere else except from Lyndon LaRouche and his movement. Now, you can get the most recent webcasts given by Lyndon LaRouche are now in a pamphlet. The pamphlet has two webcasts, the pre-election, the October 31st webcast, and then the one after the election. That's available. You can call us at 800-929-7566. We're going to distribute at least a million of these between now and the time the Congress gets into session. So it's 800-929-7566. And when you call in to order pamphlets, don't forget to make a contribution to LaRouche PAC so we can print a million of these. They don't grow on trees and fall down to the earth. We've got to produce them. And this is the probably the only worthwhile production still going on in the United States. So 800-929-7566. We're back with the show. We have Jeffrey Steinberg, an editor of the Executive Intelligence Review, who has just circulated a memo called Behind the Cheney Trip to Riyadh, which is literally shaking the foreign policy establishment and shaping the reaction in the Congress. I'd like now to turn to our youth panelists who have been circulating this memo and getting out the webcast pamphlet. Let's start with Nico Paulson in Washington, D.C. Nico, how's it going there?
Quite well, actually. Just to echo some of the things that Jeff was discussing, the really big issue that everyone's attention here in Washington is focused on, and to a large degree because of some of the actions which the LaRouche youth movement have taken here recently, is impeachment, which up until the November 7th election, and even actually right after that, really was not taken as a serious political issue by too many people here in Washington. The response that we usually got when we would discuss this with the population or people in Congress was that this was simply a fanciful thing to say, and it was not really a political reality, and it wasn't something that they were going to do in the near future. And then you had the November 7th elections, which we played a significant role in determining the outcome of. And even right after that, you still had a certain tendency against impeachment. You obviously had this statement from Pelosi and that being echoed by various other people from Dean and others in the Democratic Party. But building up to the webcast that LaRouche held on November 16th, where he initiated a new direction for the Democrats and Republicans in Congress to take coming out of that election, we had about 70 young people from all up and down the East Coast and the Midwest in the United States with a heavy focus in the U.S. Congress and in Washington, D.C., organizing specifically for double impeachment. What we were primarily using was a statement that had just come out from LaRouche in response to the post-election press conference which George Bush had given. The title was Bush Sings His Swan Song. And the leaflet was discussing not so much the previous crimes that the administration committed, but the reason for the necessity of removing both Bush and Cheney from office being that these people were simply incompetent to deal with the collapse of the U.S. dollar and financial system and wars that would be pushed by Cheney in reaction to this. And so we took that into the Congress and distributed thousands of these in about 3 or 4 days in Washington, and in particular in the U.S. Congress. And it didn't really matter whether the staff members were Democrats or Republicans, or, you know, to a certain extent, it didn't really matter whether they agreed or disagreed strongly with what we were saying, because the overall effect it had when all of our East Coast and Midwest movement came out here and organized in this way, the idea was established and became overtly a topic of discussion throughout the city as a result of this activity. And then LaRouche gave this webcast, which had very significant viewership here in D.C. and throughout the country and also throughout the world. And we noticed a very significant change in the types of responses that we were getting, both in the Congress and also people that we were meeting from institutions on the street, where now this was something that was clearly on the table and was clearly being discussed. People just coming up from places like the IMF and the World Bank or the State Department and demanding to know what LaRouche was saying and about impeachment in particular and about what the direction economically was that the United States was going to take in the next couple of months and how he was planning to steer or move the Democratic Party. Actually, there was one instance where a Republican congressional office that we went into and spoke with wanted to speak with us. They actually set up a meeting with the LaRouche Youth Movement to get an insight into what the Democrats were planning on doing.
Well, Nico, the Congress is going to be in session, I believe, for this week. I guess just this week, but I assume you have some plans for them coming up.
Yeah, this coming week, what we're going to focus on heavily is the Economic Recovery Act, which is going to be reprinted in the EIR, and we're going to take this and get it to each one of the offices, and it should be a major part of what the Democrats are working with over the next 70 or 80 days, or the first 70 or so days of the congressional session, because this is really what we're going to organize a Democratic majority to push heavily as an economic solution at this point.
Well, the Economic Recovery Act is going to be in the next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, and again, people who want to get literature to study and to circulate, you can give us a call at 800-929-7566 to get in contact with us and see if we can arrange getting a copy to you of the Economic Recovery Act. Let me go to Mike Vandernat, who's now in the Midwest. Obviously, Mike, the organizing there, you have a very large Middle Eastern population in the Detroit area, but you also have a large number of auto workers who have lost their jobs. How do you get across the interconnection between the economic crisis in the United States and the policy of clash of civilizations of the Bush-Cheney administration?
Well, I can tell you that yesterday we had a good deployment to the mosques. And many people, many of the Arab population here are familiar with LaRouche. We were able to print up the one-page memo from Jeff in Arabic to distribute with the latest webcast pamphlet.
Uh-huh.
So that was very successful. And with the auto workers, we've been obviously we have a long established contact base with the auto workers and the unions, and we were getting bundles picked up, trying to get the whoever's left to circulate these webcast pamphlets through the factories. And I think this week we'll have, as the schools approach their exams, we're going to have to look for alternative deployments, such as the auto plants.
Now, Mike, I know you're from the Midwest originally, and you've been out on the West Coast for the last few years. Did you notice the difference when you came back this time, with the effect of the shutdown of the auto sector?
Yeah, I've been through a lot of the cities. Around Detroit, I was in Grand Rapids. We were down in parts of Ohio, Cleveland, and Toledo. And it's honestly, it's pretty ugly. These cities are very run down, and the population is leaving. So it is, this is the kind of reality that we bring to the students. I don't know. Some of these people in Ohio, they come from small towns. So they're able to see in a more immediate way the longer devastating effects of globalization, and can connect better with what we're asking the Congress to do. Whereas if you go to a major university like U of M, these are children from a more privileged background, and they have a harder time connecting with the fact that the service economy is a fraud. So, this is the nature of the work. We just have to keep reminding people of the real alternative in the isotope economy.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, let me ask you on this, because part of your work is on Capitol Hill. Obviously, in Ohio, there was a political rejection, a very sharp one, of the Bush administration. The Democrats won a Senate seat, the governor's seat, and I think two or three congressional seats. What do you expect? Do you think that this freshman class is going to be mobilizable on these questions of global economic reform, in addition to the impeachment question? Do you think that's something that's going to be on the agenda?
There will be an impulse in that direction. The key challenge is going to be educating people. We had some discussions this past few days involving Mr. LaRouche and some people up on the Hill. And what Mr. LaRouche emphasized is that we are already in the throes of the worst global financial disintegration in modern history. He made a forecast over the summer of a turning point coming around September of this year. And in fact, since September, the dollar has been on a free fall. It's lost over 7% of its value. against the euro. It's even falling against the British pound. And we're headed into a period where any one of a number of things could trigger a complete collapse of the entire global financial system. What Mr. LaRouche said is if you reach the point where the dollar collapses 20%, then you're going to have a chain reaction monetary crash worldwide. So when you put that issue on the table, I can assure you there is no one in Congress, really not even anybody in the circles of the former Clinton administration, who have thought through exactly what emergency steps have to be taken, in what sequence, and how to put the whole global system through a bankruptcy reorganization. Lyndon LaRouche is the only person who's thought that through and who has a clear plan for what to do when that blowout happens. And so we've got a tremendous opening and opportunity because of what the youth movement did leading into the November 2nd Democratic Party victory. But by the same token, we've got a monumental educational challenge on our hands. I believe that we're up to it. And the big question is going to be whether or not people in the decision-making circles within the Democratic Party, among many leading Republicans, whether they're going to rise to the occasion, whether they're going to sit down and talk to LaRouche directly, and whether they're going to recognize that in this context, getting Cheney and Bush out of office is a precondition for any kind of successful solution. And there's nowhere outside the United States, no other country or combination of countries that's going to be able to do this. It's got to come from inside the U.S., and it's our mission to achieve it.
You're listening to Jeff Steinberg. This is the LaRouche Show for December 2nd, 2006, where we're looking forward to monumental events in the days and weeks ahead. Now, when you talk about an educational process, nowhere is that more essential than the great northwest of the United States, where many people think they live in ecotopia and that their thoughts tend toward tall trees and giant whales. So sometimes you have a hard time getting them to think about these things. But the LaRouche Youth Movement is very strong up in the Seattle area. And Laura, are these questions getting through, the question of the double impeachment? What are you finding from people up in the great northwest?
Yes, that's actually what I was going to say, was that we have a very special population that we get to deal with up here, in that most of the region has come here to kind of escape reality, thinking that if you just go into the woods, then nothing will happen to you. So it's always been our biggest challenge to kind of break out of complete fantasy land, especially students on, like, the university. And I'd like to echo what Nico was saying about impeachment, that we've seen a similar response up here as well, where, you know, before and immediately after the election, the idea of impeachment, let alone double impeachment, was just, oh, that would take too long, that's never going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing we've noticed over the last week or so was that people have started to take that more seriously, take the issue of double impeachment much more seriously. And the response to the organizers has been much more contemplative on the population in terms of them really wanting to get a sense of how that would happen. What would that mean if that were to occur? What can they do to actually help make that happen? So there has been a slight shift as well in that way. And one of the things in terms of organizing that we've been doing to break the bubble of the Northwest is to really go with what LaRouche has been discussing about mass organizing. So we've not only been hitting the University of Washington, which is the main Northwest institution, heavily, but also the surrounding neighborhoods, going door to door today into the district where the students live, etc. And I think that's going to be that's going to have a really interesting reverberation over the next week or so. The other thing that's really helped crack the students here as well is discussing our organizing in D.C. with them. that's proven to be something that's really excited a lot of students that have been in discussions with us for a long time, but just kind of look at it as something that's happening outside of their reality. When we discuss our organizing on Capitol Hill and our responses there, it really kind of changes the way they're thinking about how you actually intervene on history.
Mm-hmm.
So the national effect is prominent here, for sure.
Good. We have just a little less than 15 minutes, and I'd like to open the floor up to the panel for questions and discussion with Jeff. But let me start it by raising something for you, Jeff, which people tend to ask quite often among the LaRouche youth movement in trying to figure out how do you sustain a strategic picture so that you're not trapped in the kind of little thinking that much of the population has. When you put together a memo such as the one that you did, which is now in the largely shaping the discussion about the direction of Bush-Cheney policy, what goes into that? What do you have to do as a coordinator of intelligence for the Executive Intelligence Review? How do you put together a picture like that?
First of all, you have to make sure at all costs that you avoid any kind of fallacy of composition, by which I mean you've got to make sure that you start from a top-down overview and don't constrain yourself to looking at too narrow a field of vision, too much of a limited picture of predicates. Now, we know from both a historical as well as a current history standpoint that this administration, current Bush-Cheney administration, is not only an absolute disaster for the United States, but it's being steered by foreign enemies that also have a certain long history of intention to destroy the United States. This has been their opportunity of a lifetime, and they've been doing everything possible. So therefore, whenever we see some kind of a sudden deployment, sudden shift underway on the part of the Cheney-Bush White House, we know we've got to get on top of it, and we've got to get to the underlying truth about what's going on. So we had a regular weekly intelligence sector review meeting a week ago today. And one of the things that we knew was coming up this past week was this deployment of Cheney to Riyadh, to be followed a few days later by President Bush going to Jordan to meet with the King of Jordan and to meet with the head of the Prime Minister of Iraq, al-Maliki. And we knew that Condi Rice was going to the region as well to meet with the actual foreign ministers of this Sunni bloc of countries, Gulf Cooperation Council, plus Egypt, plus Jordan. So we knew that this was an immensely important deployment and that the U.S. media would be at best clueless and at worst purveyors of disinformation about what was really going on. So we had to puncture that veil.
Mm-hmm.
And the approach that we took was that we just blitzed calls into a whole array of contacts in the Middle East, in Washington, in other parts of the world, who we knew had a unique vantage point and access to information on what was going on. And we took all of those different readings, we put them together, we had a series of review discussions, we had conversations with Mr. LaRouche, the picture emerged. None of our individual sources gave us, quote, the whole story. There wasn't some secret document that was passed on to us, James Bond style or something like that. We engaged in a process of dialogue with a number of very senior contacts. When we got something that was a particular sort of singularity of information, we cross-checked it with others, and within literally a matter of a half a day, on Monday, we had put together an absolutely unique picture, an evaluation through dialogue with a wide range of sources on what was going on. We had a series of discussions with Mr. LaRouche, and at a certain point we said, okay, We don't have the whole story, but we have enough of the story to go with. Put it out. Saturate these networks with this as our initial evaluation of what was behind Cheney's trip to Riyadh, knowing that by intervening in this way, we'd be shaping the environment in which the rest of this deployment was going on. And so we got it out, and I think that we even didn't necessarily anticipate the full extent to which this memo would be picked up around the world and would shape discussion and debate and policy considerations in governments all over the planet. So it's really a sort of a perfect example of Mr. LaRouche's method of doing intelligence work at its best. You don't sit on the sidelines. You don't wait until you've got the absolute, perfect, complete, total picture. You intervene. You pull something together. You check it out. You poke it with a stick. You see what reactions you get. And so that's how we deploy. That's the method when it works effectively.
Well, I can tell you I've gotten more responses back from the network that I send these emails to than I have on any other issue. And people are asking for more information on it. For those people who haven't seen the memo yet and want to see it and want to get this pamphlet of the webcast out, the number again where you can call us is 800-929-7566. And if you didn't get it this time, I'll give it out once more before the end of the hour. So, Nico, Michael, Laura, any questions for Jeff?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Laura.
Go ahead.
One of the things that I know that we struggle with is that the situation in the Middle East is just extremely complicated. And we as a youth generation have really no basis in understanding real history. So what would you say, Jeff, is key in terms of getting the younger generation to actually understand the ramifications of this manipulation? Like, how do you actually get such a complicated issue across in a real way to the young generation?
Well, I think that there's certain core concepts that have to be presented as the starting point. And in a certain sense, there's no real shortcuts. There's a certain kind of immersion that you've got to get involved in. You've got to sort of plunge into it. But core concepts have to come first. And one core concept that has to be understood is the unique character of the United States as the only constitutional republic on the planet today that really meets the criterion of what the Greeks talked about in terms of a Platonic idea of republic. So that you've got, in a sense, on the long wave of history, a conflict between two rival notions of how to organize society and what the nature of mankind actually is. You have a Republican outlook that basically says that man has the capacity for creative discovery and the capacity to change the laws of the universe through human activity, through science, technology, through culture, through the organization of government that represents the best interests of the population as a whole. And that outlook is contrasted sharply with the oligarchical or Venetian outlook that says the vast majority of human beings are incapable of creative thought, and they should be treated like a certain form of cattle or chattel slaves, and that there is a elite oligarchy born to rule that should dominate the majority of human beings. And that alternative outlook is today represented by what Mr. LaRouche calls the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. So, I mean, basically, if you start from that framework, then at least you've got a reference point for studying areas of the world, areas of history, and having a sorting principle for being able to understand it. Otherwise, the way history is taught almost universally in colleges and universities today is pathetic. It's a collection of facts. It's not real history. It's not what Schiller talked about. It's not what Shakespeare discussed in his histories and tragedies. It's this fundamental issue of the fight between republicanism and oligarchism. And if you've got that framework, then a lot of hard work is still required, but at least you'll be able to come up with some legitimate hypotheses about how to understand situations as complicated as the Middle East.
Jeff, we have an email from someone who probably is expressing a view that a lot of Democrats have. It's from Robert Hill from San Luis Obispo, and he basically asked the question, how do you deal with the fact that there are a lot of Democrats who are focused, along with Howard Dean and Al Gore, on questions such as global warming, instead of that this goes against the interest, the kinds of things we're discussing. How much of a problem is that?
Well, I think that it's probably a question that any one of our youth panelists could answer even better than I could. I mean, number one, we have to pull rank on these guys. If Howard Dean were simply left to his own devices, we'd be having a very different conversation today, because in all likelihood, the Democratic Party would have barely squeaked by a narrow victory in the House, and maybe not even, and probably would not have won the Senate. It was this youth factor which we energized against the opposition and attempted sabotage by the Al Gores and the Howard Deans of the world. And, you know, I think that events are going to put the real agenda forcefully on the table over the immediate period ahead. This issue of a financial collapse is pivotal.
Yeah, that already happened on November 7th because the issue was the war and also a large number of Democrats who took up the question of the economic crisis hitting the lower 80% of family income brackets through questions such as free trade versus protectionism. So I think Gore and Dean and others who might want to turn the issue into melting glaciers and global warming are going to find that people are more concerned with whether they can put food on their table and keep a roof over their head.
In fact, I wanted to ask Mike, what's the weather like in Detroit today?
We just had a major turn. It was quite warm earlier in the week, and I think when Cheney arrived in Washington, he brought a very cold wind to the northern latitudes.
I think they're talking about blizzards all across the Midwest and into the Northeast this weekend.
Another example of global warming.
Exactly.
Well, there, a blue norther hit Texas. You know, we have a squad down in San Antonio where there's one more seat to be determined, and people in Texas can participate in that by dumping one more Bush puppet, Henry Bonilla. We're almost out of time. Jeff, do you have, as I said, I wish we had more than an hour because this is one of these topics that does bring up the whole question of universal history, the nature of man, and also this question of what is a human life about. But if you can give us a quick summary of what you're looking at for this next week.
Well, Congress is going to be briefly in session. We're going to be there in force. As Nico said, we're going to put some issues on the table, the Economic Recovery Act, things that the Congress urgently needs to take up along with impeachment. When they come back and really resume serious business with the Democratic majority in January. And I should add that on January 11th at 1 p.m. East Coast time, Lyndon LaRouche is going to be doing a webcast from Washington, D.C. So he's going to have a great deal to say to the incoming Democratic majority Congress about what kinds of steps they're going to have to take. By the time LaRouche takes to the podium and Congress is sworn in, we may already be in the throes of a massive economic and financial and monetary meltdown.
Unfortunately for the nation, Lynn will be speaking before Bush gives his State of the Union address or his state of his own state. Jeff, we're out of time. Sorry to have to cut you off.
No problem.
800-929-7566 for your literature. This has been the LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week.